This is the Mojo, the Meaning of Life and Business podcast, where life and business intersect. Hosted by Jennifer Glass, CEO of Business Growth Strategies International and BGSI Coaching. We are dedicated to your success. Hello and welcome to another episode of Mojo, the Meaning of Life and Business. On our show today, we're going to be talking about winning the war for talent. We all know how hard it is to be finding the right people to come to us for a position, to be working with us in a way that's really going to be making that connection, to be allowing us to reach our ultimate goal in our businesses. One of the things that we know that we need, therefore, then, are the right kinds of people that we need to be attracting, we need to be retaining, and we need to incentivize to even bring their folks and their friends aboard as well when we're needing additional people just like them. I've got a really interesting guest on the show today who's going to help us break down all about winning the war for talent. But before I bring my guest on, let me tell you a little bit about him. Over the last 15 years, Richard Triggs has been, and his team have been responsible for recruiting over 1,500 senior executives and board directors into roles across Australia. Richard has also coached over 2,500 senior executives and board directors through their job search. He is the author of the best-selling book, Uncover the Hidden Job Market, How to Find and Win Your Next Senior Executive Role, and is soon to release the second book, Winning the War for Talent, How to Attract and Retain Top Performers. He is the host of the Arete podcast and the Winning the War for Talent podcast. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's great to be here today, and I'm thoroughly looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Absolutely, and thank you again. So, Richard, let me ask you, first of all, I mean, you and your team have coached over 2,500 senior executives and board directors. I mean, that's, you know, a pretty sizable amount. If you were to boil down one thing that you learned out of those 2,500 people that you worked with, is there any like high level common denominator?
Look, I think that's an excellent question. And what I would probably say is that for the vast majority of senior executives, they are very good at their job. They have achieved great things in their career. And yet when it comes to building their networks in order to find a new job and presenting themselves for new jobs, often they are not very skilled at it. And I suppose finding a job is something that most people during their career, perhaps they've had three or four jobs in their career, perhaps some of those jobs have come through applying for a role that's been advertised and going through that sort of traditional recruitment path, and other jobs they may have been headhunted into those roles. And so let's say over a course of their career, they might have had three or four new jobs. When you think about that time compared with their entire career, it's a very small amount. So often they come to me and they say, you know what, Richard, I've been working so hard for the last 4 or 5 years, but I haven't put any attention on building out the right networks and doing what I need to do to find that next opportunity. And now I'm in the market, either voluntarily or involuntarily. They might have been made redundant or have been terminated from the roles. They're often feeling quite lost. And they get demoralized very easily because they're getting poor advice from recruiters, and they're applying for jobs and they're not getting interviews. And so often when they come to me, it's like, Richard, I know that I'm good, but I don't know what I need to do to find this new role. So I don't actually do this for money. You know, my business is being retained by employers to find staff. But obviously, because of what I do, a lot of people come to me asking for help with their own job search. So for the 15 years that I've owned and run Arete, I've run webinars and I've done some private coaching. I've obviously written a book, Uncover the Hidden Job Market, and I've tried to create a whole heap of collateral and things to support the job seeker, because that is just my way of being of service. So I would say that's a very common situation that I'm facing when I'm talking to people in that situation.
So a lot of people, again, we go through our network, like you mentioned, and if we're in the business of sales or an executive in a business, we know what that means, right? We're looking for relationships. We're looking for the kinds of partners that can be there to introduce us to someone that needs our product or service or widget. It's looking for the right kinds of speaking opportunities. If you're a speaker or if you're an author, getting your book out there and things along those lines. So I'm curious to know, if I'm looking at it from the perspective of one of these executives who are looking now, like you said, voluntarily or involuntarily, at needing to get their next position, is there anything that they can, if you will, transferable skills from the networking and everything they were doing before? Or is this a new way that they have to train their mind as they're really going through it? Or is it like the example, the painter's house is always unpainted because we got blinders on and we don't see what's over here. We only see what's over here. And sure. So when it comes to building our network for that, like you said, the hidden job market, that we don't again see what's over here because out of sight, out of mind.
Right. All right. Well, so I think that there's a lot of truth to what you've just said. And it's interesting because, you know, with the day that I turned 15, I'm now 55, about to turn 56. So the day I turned 15 was when I was legally allowed to get my first job in Australia. And so I went down to the local shopping center and I essentially walked into the various shops that I wanted to work at. And I said, look, I turned 15 today and would you like to hire me? And eventually I walked into one of the big supermarket chains here in Australia called Woolworths. And they said, oh, we'd love to hire you. Can you start tomorrow? And I started tomorrow. Really, nothing has changed. However, a lot of people have forgotten the fact that you can approach directly your employers of choice and ask them for a job. So when you think that at least 80% of the best jobs are never advertised, they're never with recruiters, they're never in the open job market, they're filled through the hidden job market. So what does that mean? It means if a company can identify somebody who can solve their problems and take away their pain, they will hire them, even if there isn't a current vacancy. If somebody is limiting their job search to only applying for roles that are advertised and only talking to recruiters, then number one, they're only seeing a very small number of the actual jobs. And number two, the competition for those roles can be very high. And because recruiters are lazy and stupid, and I say that a bit tongue in cheek because I am a recruiter, you know, recruiters just want to put the squarest peg in the square hole, get paid and move on. So if they advertise a role and there's 200 applicants, the recruiter will say, okay, well, what's the top 10 squarest pegs for my square hole? And if that's not you, you're not going to get an interview. Even if you think, oh, I could do this job standing on my head, a recruiter is not incentivized to try and put a round peg in a square hole, especially internal talent acquisition teams who are often working on, you know, 30, 40 plus vacancies at any one time. So if you want to access a hidden job market, what do you need to do? You need to get in front of your employer of choice before they know that they need you. And the fantastic thing is that LinkedIn now makes that almost immediate. So let's say your employer of choice is, pick a name, any name, Apple. And you work in the marketing area. And so you think, who do I know that might know somebody that might know the chief marketing officer at Apple? And I'm wondering if I could ask them to leverage, you know, and get me a meeting. That used to be very difficult. Well, now you can get on LinkedIn, immediately find the chief marketing officer at Apple, immediately reach out to them with a connection request and follow up with an email and ask them for a meeting. The other fantastic thing about new technology is in the past, you might have said, look, can I come and meet with you face to face? Whereas now you can say, could we have a quick meeting on Zoom or Teams? which makes it much more efficient. The person is far more likely to meet with you because you're only taking up a very small amount of their time rather than expecting 1 or 2 hours. And of course, if they're in a different geography to you, then you can just do it as you and I are today, Jennifer. So when I tell the story about me turning 15, really, it's the same thing. But a lot of people have lost sight of that. They feel that their job search is dictated to them by the roles that they see advertised and by what recruiters do. When in fact, whilst I'm definitely not saying don't talk to recruiters and don't apply for jobs, you should definitely still do that. It's just that you shouldn't only do that. At the same time, get very proactive. This is not networking for networking's sake. It's not going to a networking function and walking up to 30 strangers and saying, hey, can I have your business card? This is very targeted, direct approaching to your employer of choice in order to access these opportunities. And I know, Jennifer, we might mention this later on, but my first book, Uncover the Hidden Job Market, is a complete methodology. And if anybody is interested in getting a copy of that book, they can go to my website and they can get a copy of that for free. Again, coming back to your original question, you know, what am I seeing commonly with these senior executives? That they're awesome people. They just don't know what they don't know about finding a job. So if I can help by providing an insider view from the perspective of being an executive recruiter for over 20 years, you know, then it's something that I'm extremely happy and delighted to do.
And one of the things that struck me when you were saying earlier about going up, like you said, to the CMO of Apple, I don't know if you had a chance to see the movie A Million Miles Away. It's an Amazon Prime movie. But basically, the idea is that there was this gentleman who was so invested in being an astronaut. And it's a true story of the first Latino man who went into space. Mm-hmm. And basically, the story was that he kept on applying to NASA over and over and over. Every year, he'd send in his application. Every year, he'd get back a rejection letter. And one time, he flew down to Houston to actually give the letter in himself because he said, they can't turn me down immediately if I just give it in. You know, they still may send me a rejection later on, but they're not going to turn me down right away. And so it's that exact idea when you were just saying, like, you go, you connect, you find the chief guy in whatever company it is that you want, and you can do that. And so that idea just struck me that it reminded me of that story. But so thank you. So let me ask you, when we're then looking at getting over ourselves, right? Because if we're talking about going to the CMO of Apple, one of the things, again, that some executives may have, I mean, if you're a C-suite executive, going to the C-suite at Apple may or may not be a major deal for you. Like if you're a C-suite of a really small company, it's going to be a little bit more of a deal. If you're a C-suite of a equal Fortune 500 company, it's going to be a little bit less of an issue. But do you find some of these executives are battling imposter syndrome as well in what they're doing? Like, how can I go and talk to the CMO of Apple as an example? Like, who am I? Or I'm curious to know what you've come across there.
The answer to that is definitely. I think by now I've probably given away or sold at least 15, if not 20,000 copies of my book. I would say that 98% of people who read my book don't apply. So they say, oh, Richard, I read your book. It was fantastic. And I really got so much out of it. And I say, okay, well, so what have you done? Well, I've updated my LinkedIn profile. And anyway, Richard, what jobs have you got on at the moment that might suit me? And I say, well, how are you going in terms of reaching out to your employers of choice? And they say, I'm not doing it. And whilst they'll come up with a whole heap of excuses as to why the cat got stuck in the tree, the dog ate my homework, you know, my husband wanted me to paint the fence, whatever, right? The reality is that they're either too lazy to do it, they're too egotistical to do it, or they're too scared of rejection, okay? When I say too egotistical, you know, certainly people, I mean, I'm 55, but, you know, some of these more senior people are saying, look, why should I have to reach out to them? Shouldn't they be reaching out to me? And I say, well, how's that working out for you? You know, so there is this resistance to do it. But I think most of the resistance is exactly what you alluded to. It's not necessarily imposter syndrome. It's more, why should I feel that I have the right to disturb this person? They're probably really busy. They've probably got plenty of other things to do. So therefore, I'm not going to do it. Okay. So there's a few things that I talk about in terms of getting over that. So the first thing is, going back to your example of the guy who's the astronaut, he flies down to NASA and he hands in his CV. When I'm talking about reaching out, you would never reach out to HR or talent acquisition unless you're an HR person. Why do I say that? Well, because they've got a very tactical orientation. They're thinking, I have these 30 or 40 current vacancies. You know, does Mary suit one of those vacancies? No, she doesn't. Thanks, but no thanks. You know, send us through your CV. We'll put it in the system. You'll probably never hear from us, but that's how it is. So what I suggest is you reach out to the person that you think your role would most likely report through to. If you're a graduate marketing person and you think, oh, Apple are my employer of choice, you probably wouldn't reach out to the CMO, because they're just too removed from the person that is going to make a hiring decision about you. You want to try and find the person that you think is ultimately going to be the key decision maker. Why do you want to get in front of them? Because rather than having a tactical consideration, they've got a strategic consideration. They're thinking, what projects have I got coming up this year? What people in my team are underperforming and need to be replaced, or what people are retiring, or, you know, so they're constantly thinking about, you know, this term, their human capital, right? The other thing to understand is that they want to hire you, okay? They can't hire you if they don't know who you are. So it is your responsibility to make them know about you. I mean, we all hear about the war for talent, and we might talk about that a little bit later on, but you know, companies want to hire great people. So what you want to do is you want to get in front of that person. Now, what I say is you don't reach out to the CMO. Let's continue with the Apple example. You don't reach out to them, and let's call that person Sam, and say, hey, Sam, have you got a job? Right? Because all Sam can do is say yes or no. Probably Sam, the CMO of Apple, would direct you to HR. And as I've already said, you don't want to talk to HR. Not that there's anything wrong with HR. It's just they're plenty busy, right? So instead, when you reach out to Sam, the CMO of Apple, the approach is to say, Sam, I hope you can help. I'm hoping you can help me, please. People love to help people. I'm hoping you can help me, please. You know, I'm a marketing executive within the computer industry or the technology industry or whatever, and I'm starting to look for my new career opportunity. I'd love to get your advice about the market and where the right opportunities might be for me. In the first instance, could I have a 15-minute Zoom or Teams conversation with you? So number one, you're asking them to help. People love to help people. Number two, you're asking them for advice. You're not asking them for a job. So people love to give back. People love to offer advice. Of course, Sam, the CMO of Apple, is not an idiot, right? They're obviously going to understand that at least part of your motivation is that you're looking for a new job. So when they look at your LinkedIn profile, and your LinkedIn profile makes you look awesome because it clearly articulates your key achievements and your transferable skills, Sam wants to talk to you. Part of Sam's role is to build a bench of talent, right? And you're only asking for 15 minutes. Well, everybody's got 15 minutes. So the uptake of those meetings is very, very high. Of course, you've got to put yourself out there and ask for them, but people are often amazed. Wow, you know, I got a meeting with the CMO of Apple and I go, for sure. I mean, this works, right? And then when you're in front of them, once you can understand where their pain points are and you can demonstrate that you can solve them through your key achievements and transferable skills, they will hire you. So what I say to people is, rather than, you know, seeing this as an insurmountable task, if you just each day blocked an hour in your diary, and in that 1 hour, you identify three employers of choice, you identify the three key decision makers, you send three LinkedIn connection requests, and you send three emails asking for a 15-minute meeting. If you do that every day, that's 15 per week. That should get you a minimum of 2 to 3 meetings. After all, this is a numbers game. If you had 2 to 3 meetings a week for 12 weeks, based on my experience of coaching hundreds of people through this process, within 12 weeks, if not far sooner, you should definitely have a new job, right? But coming back to your original point, you know, Jennifer, 98% of people won't do it. And I think you guys are crazy. Why would you choose to be unemployed or underemployed when you could go out and create the next opportunity for yourself and do it within 3 months? You're an awesome candidate. You've achieved awesome things. People definitely want to hire you. They can't hire you if they don't know who you are.
Thank you, Richard. And so what I want to do is I want to take a turn and I want to have us focus now on looking at it from the perspective of the executive and the hiring managers. So yep. You and I are both executives in our businesses, and we're looking at what we know we've got going on, excuse me, in our business. We are looking at what projects, like you said, we've got on the horizon for the next 9 months or so for the year. We're looking at the broader picture. We're looking at where the economy is going. Here in the United States, the presidential election can dictate some of how the economy is going to be looking like come 2025. So there's a lot of consideration in terms of headcount, in terms of opportunities, things along those lines. So if I'm now looking at just trying to form what I need over the next, let's just say 9 months to finish up 2024, if I'm not consciously though thinking about adding headcount, if somebody comes to me and says that, you know, they want to take a meeting, like you said, a CMO is pretty smart. He's going to get that they're looking for that position. Would you still recommend that the executive at least have the conversation with that person just in case something is available to at least know them? What would you counsel that executive?
So you're talking about the hiring manager. Would I suggest that the hiring manager has that meeting? Well, of course, the answer to almost all of these questions is it depends, right? So I'm not suggesting that a hiring manager would meet people just for the sake of having a meeting. I mean, we're all busy. We've all got heaps of competing priorities. And so somebody who reaches out who is not relevant to your business based on what you are forecasting and so on, you may choose at that point not to have the meeting. But if somebody reaches out to you, and again, let's use this Apple example. So let's say that somebody reaches out and you looked at their LinkedIn profile and you could see, wow, you know, they're a marketing person. They've worked for IBM and they've worked for Microsoft, and based on their LinkedIn profile, they've achieved some great outcomes, or perhaps they might be a very senior marketing person from an adjacent industry who's got skills that you think could well and truly be transferable into your business, I would definitely recommend that you have the meeting. Because the reality is, once that person's in front of you, there may be things that they can talk about which make you think, wow, this is opportune. I know that I needed to replace Fred in 4 months because Fred's retiring, but Jennifer's just showing up and she's awesome. Why do I want to go through a hugely protracted, expensive recruitment process when I can just grab Jennifer and get on with business, right? Too few hiring executives, and again, I'm not talking about HR or talent acquisition, I'm talking about, you know, line managers, don't put attention on building their bench of talent. And so all of a sudden, they have a resignation or a termination or a new project comes online or whatever it is, and suddenly they're hustling. I need somebody in this role yesterday. And I can speak about that from direct experience, because as an executive recruiter, you know, who we are probably doing, over 250 roles or thereabouts a year now. Okay, so that's a lot for a small boutique business like ours. 9 times out of 10, if not 19 times out of 20, when we say to the employer, when do you want this person? They go, yesterday. And because there's this high degree of urgency, now that's only the employers that come to me, right? So if you think about it, the fact that companies are now building out talent acquisition teams, they've been doing that for some time because they now have LinkedIn recruiter licenses. And so they think that their reliance on third-party recruiters is not nearly as necessary anymore because, hey, it's so much cheaper. You know, for the cost of 2 hires through an external recruiter, we can hire Sally, our internal recruiter, and pay her salary for a whole year, right? So they're coming to Sally. Oh, Sally, we need this person. We need them yesterday. And Sally goes, oh, I've got 30 to 40 jobs on. So, you know, Sally is not headhunting. She has a very limited brief. That is competing with her priorities for all of these other roles. And so as a result, often the hiring manager gets a short list of candidates that they are underwhelmed by, both the quality and the quantity of candidates. And so they go, Sally, these candidates, I'm underwhelmed. And she says, oh, sorry, boss, it's a war for talent. Okay. Now, my whole premise is that there's not actually a war for talent. There are just companies who know how to hire well. And then there's the majority of companies who don't know how to do it well. And one of the points, you know, amongst many, is that as a hiring manager, you need to constantly be in the market, even if it is talking on podcasts, writing articles, speaking at conferences. If you are building your personal brand as an employer of choice within your market, you will start to attract highly talented people who want to come and work for you. Again, most senior leaders go, oh, that sounds great, Richard, but I'm so busy. You know, I'm up to my neck in crocodiles. I don't have any time to do that. And then suddenly I've got a role, we can't fill it, and they're desperate.
So in terms of looking, in terms of looking at how I can build, like you said, your bench of talent.
Yep.
So you're saying that I should be writing articles, appearing on podcasts, speaking at conferences, things along those lines, that it builds that brand of the executive as well as the company. So right, that when someone is looking, that would be an employer of choice to be where they would want to go. Did I understand that right?
Yeah. Now, you did, although obviously people have limited time to do these things. But if we talk, you know, about this process of attracting top talent, Well, the first thing is about, well, how do we position ourselves as an employer of choice? Now, if you look at most companies' websites, they are beautifully presenting their goods and their services, you know, to attract people who want to buy whatever it is that they sell. And yet these companies say our asset is our people, our greatest asset is our people, and there's a war for talent. And yet you look at their websites, how much of their website is actually focused on attracting top talent? You know, where are the success stories of their people? If they're loud and proud about, you know, being a champion for the diversity, where's that demonstrated? You know, where are the key achievements of the executive leadership team and key people in the business promoted in a way that somebody would look at the website and go, wow, Jennifer's business, look at what they're doing. Geez, they look amazing. I would love to work for Jennifer. Okay. They're literally spending, not obviously us, but, you know, these bigger companies are spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on putting an ad on the Super Bowl, right? And then you look at the LinkedIn profiles of the executive leaders in those businesses, and they're terrible. Most people's LinkedIn profile is just a summary of their career experience. Your LinkedIn profile as an employer is your zero moment of truth. Every single person that is wanting to interact with you is looking at your LinkedIn profile before deciding, is this somebody I want to work for? But it's not just about attracting employees. Your LinkedIn profile is also looked at by your suppliers, your customers, your competitors, your financiers, your joint venture partners. Everybody is looking at your LinkedIn profile. So if you think, what do I need to do to make my LinkedIn profile attract the people that I want to work for me? Once again, talking about your key achievements and transferable skills, talking about your organization and presenting it in a way that makes it look like a very attractive company to work for, getting recommendations, which are testimonials on your LinkedIn profile from your staff and your peers and other people that say, you know, I worked for Jennifer for 3 years and she was the best job, best boss that I ever had. Those things are so easy to do, literally cost nothing to do, and yet nobody does them. Okay, so appearing on podcasts, talking at conferences, you know, doing these things is good if you have the time and capacity to do that. But, you know, again, we've all got our day job to do, so we have to be realistic about our capacity to do those things. But at a very minimum, saying this is why I'm an employer of choice, and demonstrating that through testimonials and through examples of people who have thrived under your leadership is going to make you stand out, you know, as being one of the top 1%. And it's simple to do, and companies should really be considering investing in the time to make sure that they're doing that, especially for their senior leadership team.
Well, let me ask you, because you raised an interesting point there, and I'm curious to get your take on it. So if I have people on my team, and whether it's a big company, small company, whatever it is, first of all, exit interviews being an important piece of ending someone's relationship with the company, but let's say that they've got the exit interview down and they know how to use that. But should part of that process also be from HR encouraging people who are leaving under favorable terms, at least, to leave a review at Glassdoor and things along those lines as well? Or is that a different kind of situation that may be a different, again, depends kind of story?
Well, I suppose it doesn't hurt. And if somebody's leaving under favorable circumstances, then they should feel quite comfortable in making those recommendations or doing those testimonials. To be honest, it's something that I hadn't thought about, and I'm not aware of companies that are doing that. but it would make complete sense for them to do it. But I think going back to your point about exit interviews, you know, often the exit interview is too late. Again, most of the time in an organization, if you're a good leader, you're across your team and why they stay or why they leave. And another thing I talk about in my book, more from a retention point of view, is that as a leader, you should be asking your direct reports. Okay, so let's say one of my direct reports, his name is Mary. And I say, look, Mary, you have lots of choice. You could be working for many, many other companies than mine. I would like to ask you, what are the three reasons that you love working for me? And the interesting thing is that if you ask that question, Mary is going to tell you, and often what she will say may be things that you are surprised by, and you might have 12 Marys in your team, and you'll be surprised by how varied their responses are. You know, so somebody might say, I love the variety of the work. I love the clients. I love the team. I love the technology. I love the flexibility. I love the remuneration, whatever it is. It's very important to use that term, why do you love working for me? Because I only want people to work for me who love working for me. If they don't love working for me, we have to create a situation where they do love working for me, or they should exit and go and work for somebody that they actually would love to work for. The thing is, if Mary says, this is why I love working for you, Richard, then as her boss, my responsibility is to continue to give her what she loves, noting that it is a reciprocal transaction. So if I'm going to give Mary what she loves, then she needs to give me what I love, which is, you know, a high performance team member who is, you know, a good cultural fit and, you know, whatever the other attributes that I want. Okay. I would suggest that if you went and spoke to 100 leaders and said, how many of the people in your immediate reports that how many of those do you actually know why they love working for you? Out of 100, I'd be amazed if one person could honestly say yes. They'll say, look, I suppose Mary loves working for me because I'm a good guy and because, you know, she gets paid well. Well, that's just not enough, right? So if you have to wait till the exit interview, so Mary, you know, why are you leaving? Well, because, you know, I used to get to work with this cutting edge technology, but in recent years, there hasn't been the reinvestment. And because of that, I've decided that I want to go and work for somebody who's more invested in, you know, world's best practice. Too late. She's gone. Right. So, again, my book, Winning the War for Talent, is not just about how do you attract, but it's also how do you retain and build high performance teams. Because the last thing that you want as an employer, having invested all of that time and all of that money in bringing Mary into the business and getting her through her learning curve and getting her to the point that she's performing well and it's a great cultural fit for the business, and then they leave. I mean, that's the cost financially and psychologically when that happens is something that you want to avoid at all costs.
So I hear your point on the exit interview being too late and the idea that you should be asking, why do you love working for me? Why do you love working for the company? As a way of really connecting with your team.
Yep.
But as we look at retention efforts, right? I mean, there's other things other than just the, what do you love working for me kind of questions. Is there anything else on a retention level, though, that we should be looking at that a lot of people may not be? I mean, obviously, bonuses and compensation, things along those lines, we know that that's standard as reasons why people are going to leave. You know, it's a lateral move or it's you're just giving me significantly more money. That's going to be a reason somebody is going to be moving. But is there anything else, though, outside of that, that executives are not necessarily tuned into that we should be thinking about in terms of retention efforts for our people?
Well, there are certainly lots of things to think about. I suppose the point you made at the beginning, well, okay, sure, you can understand why Mary loves working for you, but that doesn't necessarily mean you'll retain her. Of course, that's true. But if you're asking that question consistently and frequently enough, and not every week, but you might ask Mary that twice a year, then hopefully if there are things that are starting to scratch her, I don't feel I'm being remunerated appropriately or whatever it might be, then you would hope that she would proactively talk to you about that in order to be able to get what she wants. But, the last chapter in my book is called knowing when to say goodbye. And the reality is that if you invest your time into mentoring and developing people, there will come a point where, they have to leave the nest. Coming back to your actual question, though, good leadership is about being able to balance love and accountability. So if I have a team and I love them too much, or not too much, but if I love them, but I don't hold them accountable enough, they will become soft and they will underperform and my business won't, or my team won't achieve its full potential. If, on the other hand, I have too much accountability, in other words, hard KPIs and hard metrics that people need to achieve, and there's not enough love, then what happens? People become brittle and they either become very self-serving in that they only care about achieving their own personal KPIs, et cetera, or they leave. So it's finding that fine balance between love and accountability that enables you to retain and develop high performance teams. At the end of the day, people want to be loved, right? We all want to be loved. And particularly if we're working longer hours than we are spending with our family, right? We want to do that in an environment that is loving and nurturing, of course. But the other thing is people want to be accountable. They want to know that they're doing a good job and they want to be recognized for doing a good job. So once again, in organizations, part of the development of leaders needs to be about how do you learn these soft skills, being more emotionally intelligent. Too often in a company, they'll say, Mary was a great, marketing executive, so we're now going to promote her to being a leader of marketing executives, without thinking, what do we need to do to support Mary to make that transition so that when she steps into a leadership role, she actually has the tools required to get the best out of her people. And the reality is, going and doing an MBA, which I've done, although 20 years ago, it doesn't teach you these things. These are skills that you don't learn at a university. And one of my motivations for writing the book is, in my own way, once again, to be of service, to help hiring managers to be more clear about how do I actually attract this talent, how do I keep this talent, and how do I build these high performance teams? Because if I have a high performance team, that's going to allow me as a leader to have a far more enjoyable job as well, rather than feeling that I have to do the work of everybody because I can't trust them to delegate to them.
Right. So if we're looking at where a business can be, right, like you were just saying, you came out with the book to be of service and to help them think of all of these different areas. And so they're going through the, like you said, asking Mary two times a year, or maybe with the reviews, why do you love working for the company or for me? Paying attention to the compensation, paying attention to what else is happening, and that mix of the love and accountability that you mentioned in terms of all of those different pieces. So I guess one of the other questions though is there also a grading system that you're asking your people, like, can you rate me as a leader so that I can improve also, or is that different? I'm curious to know how you would counsel those heads of companies.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously there are lots of rating systems that are in place, like 360 degree feedback or employee engagement scores, et cetera. A lot of those tools are done anonymously, and a lot of them are delegated to the HR team to roll out. Now, so for example, some companies will delegate the performance review process to somebody from HR. Well, as much as HR might be very well intentioned in terms of doing that, they don't actually hold the relationship. Okay, so leadership is about a one-on-one communication between me and my subordinate, my employee. Trying to delegate that to somebody else to manage gets away from the whole benefit of being in that relationship. And secondly, using tools like 360 degree feedback, et cetera, may be of some value, but when people are filling it out anonymously, often the feedback, you know, can be a bit of pill to swallow. So I'll give you an example from my own career. So probably maybe 10 or so years ago in my business, we had a team of 14 people, and I did this little weekend course through my business coach around a 360 degree feedback tool called LSA, which is the lifestyle index, but it's really a 360 degree feedback around leadership. And here was I at the time having one-on-ones with my team and feeling confident that I was supporting them and mentoring them and being very generous and being a great boss. And then when the results came back from the LSA test, basically all these people said that I was terrible. And so I had this, at the time I felt absolutely and utterly gutted. I was so floored by that feedback to think, how can these people who I've literally bent over backwards to do the absolute best I can as a leader then give me feedback through this tool that I'm actually a terrible boss? This is prior to me learning and implementing, you know, what I'm talking about that I've implemented in my business and now coached many people to implement in their businesses and so on, which is what's in the book. Now, that would never have happened if I had actually had a relationship with the employee where we were having regular conversation. You know, why do you love working for me? Obviously, part of that is to get feedback about how can I improve my ability to support you. Okay. And it's a little bit like trolls on the internet, right? Some people will write the most vile and horrendous things because they feel that they could do that anonymously that they would never, ever do if they were actually addressing you face to face. And this is comes back a little bit to what we were talking about before we started the podcast. Good quality, consistent, regular communication is the key here. And trying to replace that with tools and surveys and exit interviews and performance reviews, et cetera, in my mind, actually is a distraction and it detracts from the quality of relationship.
And I'm sorry that LSI test showed such poor results.
Well, you know, I think it was as I firmly believe everything is exactly as it should be. Why? Because it is. And having that feedback at that time certainly caused me to have a lot of introspection about my leadership style and about things that I needed to take responsibility for in order to, give more of myself to my people. And I think this idea of servant leadership, which is as a leader, I'm here to serve my people. They're not here to serve me. Perhaps there's a pendulum swinging too far in the other direction. It's got to be a relationship of mutual reciprocity. But it was a disappointing thing, but it pushed me further on my journey to learn and implement more to have a far more cohesive and successful team in the future.
Absolutely. And again, feedback, good or bad, is an incredible learning experience.
Definitely.
You can't get better than even negative reviews. And that's one of the things in our review management platform that we tell our clients also, because if you think about getting negative comments, negative feedback or reviews, means something didn't go right. And so we know exactly what that means, that we have to improve upon whatever it is not meeting the standards of whoever our stakeholders are. So if it's our team, if it's our clients, whatever it may be, that all becomes an important piece. And so, like you were saying, Richard, I mean, knowing that your team was seeing you in a negative light in certain regards is actually a blessing in disguise, because it allows future Richard to be that much better. That if you were continuing to go where you were before, your company may have eventually floundered, because not only were they upset, but clients may have been getting bothered as well. And so all of this can possibly be happening in that regard. But Richard, let me ask you, as we wrap up our conversation on winning the war on talent. So people were listening to our conversation and are interested in getting your books. How can they, A, get your books, and how can they connect with you?
My first book, Uncover the Hidden Job Market, was first published in 2015. A new edition came out just before Christmas. And if people want a physical copy of that book, then obviously, you can purchase it through Amazon or other similar websites. If you'd like a free version of the book, the PDF version of the book, you can come to my company website, which is www.arete.com.au. Here in Australia, we have a little AU on the end. So areteexecutive.com.au, and you'll easily find the links there to be able to download the book. I've also got three webinars which explain in very practical terms. And so that is very much aimed at the job seeker. My new book, Winning the War for Talent, is literally at the publishers as we speak. I'm expecting that book will be printed by May. And then again, if people want to purchase a copy of that, I'm sure they will be able to find that through Amazon, etc. If you'd like to reach out and connect with me, I mean, certainly if you're an employer, amazingly, one of the blessings in disguise of COVID was that prior to COVID, the vast majority, if not 90% of my clients, were Brisbane or Southeast Queensland based, because I needed to meet people and shake hands and, have coffees and form relationships. And then, of course, post that initial COVID lockdown, suddenly people are very happy to have a Zoom or a Teams relationship. So believe it or not, our little firm in Brisbane has been engaged by American companies to headhunt Americans for jobs in America, which would never, ever have happened prior to COVID. So if you're an employer and we can assist you in that regard, obviously I'd love to hear from you. If you're a job seeker, I have all of these various tools and support there for you. LinkedIn allows you to have a maximum of 30,000 connections. I constantly sit at around 29,000. And so if you send me a LinkedIn connection, don't feel if I don't accept it, it's because I don't value your connection. It's literally because I don't have room. So I would suggest, rather than sending me a LinkedIn connection, you can message me through LinkedIn or through my website and so on, and would love to chat and see how I can help you in whatever regard possible.
Thank you. And so again, definitely check out Richard's books, and you can go to areteexecutive.com.au so that you can reach out and connect. Otherwise, look up Richard, follow Richard on LinkedIn, might be an even easier way. So that way you are still seeing Richard's updates on LinkedIn. So that you can go from there and you can continue getting even more value and more knowledge as you move on. But one of the things that you do definitely want to be taking away as a takeaway from this episode is thinking about how you are being perceived by the marketplace. Are you an executive looking for a position? Are you a company that is possibly needing to deepen your bench of talent, as Richard said? If you're thinking about how the market is seeing you, if you're thinking about the way that people are thinking about you, it is going to be a really incredible opportunity for you to be looking at, all right, this is where we need to be going. This is what we need to be doing that would be different in terms of how we can make the change if need be, or you know that you're going in the right direction. One of the things that we spoke about was also looking at the idea that when people are leaving, when they are leaving, especially under favorable circumstances, think about getting them to leave reviews about their experience working for the company. We know that people are looking at that. I know that from all the people that I speak with regularly, in just reviews and other aspects, people that are coming to me asking for references, and we tell them, look, if you see what's listed on Glassdoor as an example, there's a lot there that allows us to really be getting that information. The more that you can be making sure you see exactly how people are seeing you, the more likely it is you're going to have a better opportunity finding people. And not to take anything away from Richard, because Richard, if you have anyone that needs those positions at those companies, you already know some folks that you should be sending them to. but with that, Richard, once again, thank you so much for being my guest on the show today. I think our audience got a huge value out of everything that you shared with us so far.
Wonderful. Well, thanks to you. It's always a pleasure talking to somebody on the other side of the world and realizing that even though we're so vastly apart, you know, the challenges and opportunities we face are very, very similar. And so I hope that, as you say, what I've had to discuss today has been of some value to your listeners. And I look forward to connecting with you again in the near future.
Absolutely. Again, thank you. Until next time, this has been another episode of Mojo, the Meaning of Life in Business. And here's to your success. This has been another episode of Mojo, the Meaning of Life and Business podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider leaving us a review, liking us, or reaching out to us. You can contact us at bgsicoaching.com and let us know what you think. Thanks so much again for listening.